From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, 3rd and Indiana. It's a street corner in Philadelphia that's been taken over by the drug trade, and it's the setting of a new novel by Steve Lopez. We'll talk with Lopez. He's a popular city columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Also today, I look into the African-American middle class with Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot. Her new book, I've Known Rivers, is a series of interviews with 6 African-Americans at midlife. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new compilation of Dennis Brain, Reginald Kell, and Leon Goossens playing Schumann and Beethoven. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton is preparing to speak to the nation this evening about Haiti. It is widely expected he'll present his case why the United States should invade that country. The Oval Office address will be at 9 Eastern Time and 6 Pacific Time tonight. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary William Perry says the president will call up about 1,600 military reservists. They could be used as backup for any Haiti operation.
The call-up is for units which backfill active units. The call-up does not include general-purpose combat troops. It includes reservists and specialties of tactical airlift, aerial port operations, military police, medical support, and civil affairs.
Defense Secretary William Perry. Former Virginia Governor Douglas Wilder has withdrawn from that state's U.S. Senate race. He cited bad poll results and little results from fundraising activity. 3 candidates are left in the race: incumbent Democrat Chuck Robb, independent candidate Marshall Coleman, a former Virginia Attorney General, and Republican candidate Oliver North. The former Marine colonel, who came to national attention during the Iran-Contra affair, says Wilder's withdrawal won't hurt his chances of winning.
It's close, but I'm confident that we can win this thing, as I've campaigned all across Virginia since January as a two-way race. Said it was going to come down to that. It really is Chuck Robb and his good buddy Bill Clinton versus me.
Some observers believe Wilder's supporters could now throw their support to Robb. The Federal Reserve Board has approved a key step in the formation of what could become the nation's first African-American multi-state bank holding company. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
Detroit's Omnibank Corporation, controlled by 2 African-American investors, has won approval by the Federal Reserve Board for its application to acquire Indicor, the holding company for Independence and Drexel National Banks, 2 black-owned institutions in Chicago. As part of the deal, Omnibank has agreed to increase the Chicago bank's community lending by $120 million during the next 5 years. The goal, says Omnibank Chairman William T. Johnson, is to promote urban development by building strong banking institutions in communities that traditional banks have overlooked. The acquisition must still be approved by Indicor shareholders and Illinois state banking authorities. That approval is expected by the end of this year. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
U.S. diplomats have furled the American flag and closed the office in Somalia. A U.S. official in Kenya says all U.S. diplomats at the liaison office in Mogadishu will be gone by the end of the day. The move was expected. The White House announced that the 80 diplomats would leave because of security concerns and ongoing clan fighting. On Wall Street, the Dow is up. This is NPR. Tanks and gunboats of the African Intervention Force in Liberia are pounding the Liberian presidential palace in Monrovia. They're trying to oust rebel soldiers who claim they're taking over the country. Mortars and gunfire have rocked the capital. Today's fighting has revealed the presence of yet another armed faction in the 5-year-old Liberian civil war. The troops were led by General Charles Jalui, a former follower of dictator Samuel Doe. Jalui had fled Liberia 4 years ago, but it doesn't appear that his control extends beyond the gates of the presidential palace. A promotion on the internet that claimed legal ways to fix bad credit will be yanked. A federal court has ordered the ad off the internet now that the Federal Trade Commission has filed a false advertisement complaint. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The FTC charged Brian Corzine of Sacramento, California, with making false claims and promoting a credit repair program. The commission says Corzine sold the credit repair system through a business called Chase Consulting. The FTC contends the promotion on the intranet, a worldwide computer network, claimed to provide legal ways to repair credit while actually suggesting illegal steps. Corzine says the program was developed by other people and he was just a reseller. He says it had been presented to him as perfectly legal. Corzine contends that other businesses are selling the same program, though not necessarily via computer. FTC Chairwoman Janet Steiger says as computer networks continue to grow, the commission will not tolerate the use of deceptive practices on the networks any more than they have tolerated them on other recently emerged technologies for marketing. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
General Motors workers at a transmission plant in Toledo, Ohio, have decided to authorize a strike. A possible walkout could cripple the automaker's production elsewhere. Members are worried about safety issues, production speed-ups, and overtime. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen 34.32 points to 3,929. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Steve Lopez often writes about the city's neighborhoods, their heroes and villains. Now Lopez has joined the ranks of columnists turned novelists. Fellow columnist and novelist Pete Hamill has praised Lopez's first novel for its style, dark humor, and sense of tragedy. It's called Third and Indiana, and it's set in a Philadelphia neighborhood known as the Badlands, where the streets are owned by drug dealers and neighborhood children learn to duck bullets. As the novel opens, Gabriel, a 14-year-old drug dealer, has run away from home, leaving no clues to explain his disappearance to his mother. Now she spends her nights riding a bicycle, searching the streets for him. In this passage, Gabriel is standing in a shadow, watching his mother pedal toward him on a bicycle much too small for her large body.
Maybe he should have gotten her a bigger bicycle. It had been a birthday present 6 months ago. Get some exercise, he had told her. She had put on so much weight since his father walked out on them without a word or a warning. Get some exercise, some fresh air, whatever, just get out of the house. A person could suffocate in there. It was filled with so much unspoken disappointment. But Gabriel never really expected her to ride the bike. She'd be too self-conscious, for one thing, and she'd wonder where he got the money. He didn't know her as well as he thought he did. Not only was she riding the bicycle, but she was riding it in the middle of the night, looking for him. Damn, Gabriel thought. She shouldn't be out here at this hour, not in this neighborhood. Gabriel was 14, a dark sliver of a boy with slow, sad eyes that could stay sad through a smile. He was going to be a lady killer, his mother had been telling him since before he knew what it meant, and she had said it again a week ago, the night before he ran away. His first thought was to run to her now. His second was to just run. His right foot made the decision, a slow, backward step on the toe of his sneaker, and then he wheeled and was gone, lost in the darkness beyond the L as a train rattled over Philadelphia rooftops, past the steamed windows of sleeping babies, and past corners owned and ruled by drug gangs. Ophelia Santoro of Diamond Street fought the bicycle to a stop at the intersection of Lehigh and Kensington, her chest rising with each breath. The cops and prosecutors had a name for this part of town, which took in areas of Kensington and North Philadelphia, and was good for several shootings a night and a drug trade that rivaled the gross national product of a dozen small nations. They called it the Badlands. If her husband were still around, he'd be the one out here searching the Badlands. If her husband were still around, Gabriel wouldn't have run away. That was the way she looked at it. The world wasn't worth living in, Ophelia thought, if it was a place where Gabriel could be dead and her husband could be alive. If that were the case, she'd have to find a way to get word to him. He had a right to know.
Steve Lopez, thanks for reading that. How were you first introduced to this part of the city?
Well, I got to Philadelphia about 10 years ago. I was born and raised in the San Francisco area. And I came to the Philadelphia Inquirer as a general assignment reporter. And one of my early assignments took me to that neighborhood.
What did you see there that surprised you?
I was immediately horrified, intrigued. I couldn't get enough of it. I was struck by the complete devastation. It looked to me like it was the end of the world. Houses were literally crumbling, glass all over the streets, graffiti on all of the buildings. kids selling drugs openly and doing so in the shadows of these shut-down factories. And I had, although I had seen poverty, I had seen, you know, urban problems in San Jose, California, and in Oakland and in San Francisco, I had seen nothing that came close in any way to the depth of the devastation in the neighborhood.
What were the stories that kept bringing you back to that neighborhood?
I guess I was fascinated by the fact that in the middle of all that, there are people just struggling to hold on. The people living in fear, people afraid to let their children out of the house because they might get hit by a stray bullet. People who can't remember the last time they made it through a night without hearing gunshots. And you hear these stories over and over and over again, and you realize that these are, in a way, urban heroes. These are people who, if they could get out, certainly would, but are trapped. You have situations like maybe somebody bought a house for $15,000 or $20,000 10 years ago, 12 years ago. Today, in some of these neighborhoods, that house is worth nothing. You couldn't give it away. And so they're stuck. They're stuck with gangs working on the corner. They're stuck with unemployment that gets to 50% and above. They're stuck with high schools where each year begins, say, with 500 freshmen and 100 seniors, because kids just don't make it. They either get into the drug trade or they're cut down, you know, by bullets, one thing or another. And I think what fascinated me was that there were so many people there who were just struggling to survive, people for whom the future is just tomorrow. Nobody who's thinking about where they're going to go on vacation next year or what kind of a job, you know, maybe they should work toward, and what college they're going to go to. People just struggling to hold on.
How much were you able to get to know some of the really young drug dealers, people like Gabriel on the book?
Well, it's difficult. It's difficult. One time I was on I went with police on a sweep of the neighborhood, and they made some arrests, and I got an opportunity to talk to a 16-year-old who they arrested. And I asked him what the situation was, and I spoke to him in a jail cell. He had been arrested for selling drugs, and I asked him how he got into it. And he said he had gotten in a couple years ago as a lookout. That's how you begin, and maybe you make $50 a day or maybe $100 a day. And he knew that it was wrong. He knew that he shouldn't be doing it, but other kids were doing it, and he lived on a block where just about everybody has a piece of the action, one way or another. He later got a job working, helping out a landscaper, and he was making some money, and he thought, and it was important in his household because his father had just had a heart attack, lost his job, there were no medical benefits, his mother was trying to take care of the rest of the kids. He felt that he had to be the breadwinner, and the landscaper laid him off, and he would sit in his house and look outside and hear her kids his own age making $150 a day. So he began to do it, and he got pretty good at it. There are kids who actually excel at being drug dealers, and he said, I said, how long do you think you're going to live doing this? And he said, oh, not long, maybe a couple years. And I said, and then what's going to happen? And he said, I'm going to be shot and killed, probably right here. And I said, well, why do you do it? And he said, what is my alternative? How is my family going to eat? What if my father needs medicine? And you hear these kinds of stories on a regular basis.
Why did you want to write a novel? You've been a columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer for about 8 years, is it?
It's 8 years, 9 years, yeah. I wanted to write a novel because growing up, I never read. I grew up in a house where my father drove a Wonder Bread truck. My mother took care of the kids and had dinner ready every night. And then we watched sitcoms for about 4 hours. And I was not exposed to books. Nobody in my family had been exposed to books. I went to school, became a sports writer, and then switched over and became a news reporter. And when I did that, I met people who knew about things that I had never heard of, people who had traveled the world and were talking about books and museums and music and things that I was exposed to a world that I never knew existed. And I started to play catch-up. In my late 20s and my early 30s, I began reading the classics, the books that you're supposed to read when you're in high school. I actually made it through high school and college literally without reading a single book. If there was an assignment, I would read the flap, and I would just kind of skate through, and, you know. just kind of fake it. Fake it till you make it.
You must have been pretty good at faking it.
Well, you know, I had some writing skills, but I had no interest in writing a book. I didn't know, or in reading a book, I didn't know that books were ideas. And when I started to read, one of the books that I came across was To Kill a Mockingbird. And I read it at a time in my life when I had a true appreciation for literature. And when I read that, I thought, this has got to be one of the most humane and noble acts in the 20th century, the writing of this book. Not so much because of the way that it's written, but because of what it says and how it says it. And I knew then that I wanted to, even more than learn how to play the guitar, I wanted to see if I could write a novel someday. So it began with that. It began with, I guess, out of anger a little bit, a bit of anger about not having been exposed to books early on and feeling as if I missed so much. Well, not only am I going to read them, I'm going to write them. That was sort of the attitude that I took.
My guest is Steve Lopez. He's a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of the new novel, Third in Indiana. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with columnist and novelist Steve Lopez. You had a recent column in the Inquirer about parking in South Philadelphia. And South Philadelphia is where one of the characters in your novel is from.
Right.
Italian neighborhood. A lot of powerful people in Philadelphia politics come from that neighborhood. And describe the parking things that you tried for this column.
Well, I had in Philadelphia... there is this history of certain people living by different rules than people in other neighborhoods. North Philadelphia in Philadelphia happens to be primarily black. South Philadelphia happens to be primarily white. And there is this history in the city that if you park in the middle of the street in South Philadelphia, we're talking about a four-lane thoroughfare, and down the middle of that is double yellow lines running parallel and wide enough that a car can fit in the middle. In South Philadelphia, you can park in the middle of the street. It's okay. Technically, it's against the law, but it's not enforced. And I was aware of that, of course, and was aware as well that in North Philadelphia, there are no cars in the middle of the street. So I had wanted to do this for quite a while, to take my car up to North Philadelphia and just park it in the middle of the street and see what happened. See how long it took to get a ticket or to get towed or whatever. So I drove up there one day, and I parked, and I got out, and I stood on the sidewalk, and I walked up the block, and I don't think I made it back down to the other side, and I saw somebody writing a ticket for it. And it was 7 minutes. In 7 minutes, I got a ticket. All right, got in the car, drove to South Philadelphia, parked in the middle of the street, and I waited 7 minutes. I waited a half hour, and I decided to celebrate that I would go into a little restaurant there, had a meatball sandwich to celebrate that, you know, we were up to an hour now. came out of the restaurant. The car is still there, no ticket. And so I took the subway and went home. And the next morning I checked on it, and the next night, and for 15 days went to see if they would give me a ticket or if it would have gotten towed or anything. And it was untouched.
So people in that neighborhood have special parking privileges?
Special privileges. It's, different rules in Philadelphia depending on who you know, where you live.
My favorite part of that column, like many people in Philadelphia, I have a favorite restaurant in South Philadelphia. It's a little hard to park there because on every block there's at least one or two spaces that are cordoned off for disabled parking. And I've always thought, like, how many... handicapped people can there possibly be living in this three-block radius?
That is another scam in Philadelphia. You get those through your ward leader. And, you know, we have that system here, the old machine.
So it's a way of just reserving a spot for yourself.
There you go. Yeah.
You have a column about city commissioner in Philadelphia, Marge Tartaglione, who handles elections.
Right.
And this was after, you wrote this after an article came out in the Philadelphia Inquirer about how the city is spending more for parts and maintenance of its voting machines than nearly any other city.
Right.
So what you did was you transcribed word for word what she had to say in an interview that was recorded by a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Right.
And, gee, maybe I can get you to read some of that.
Okay, this is from a two-hour interview that an Inquirer reporter did, and he asked her a question. He was asking her about why do you need so many mechanics to fix these things? Why are they paid such overtime, and why do the parts cost so much? And Marge said, it's like my husband. He used to have a gas station, all right? When they were a car came, a new car, they'd lift up the hood. Everything was metric tools. Now, it cost them a fortune to go out to buy the metric tools. Somebody says, oh, come on, you could use these. He says, yeah, and strip the bearings or strip whatever it is. Now, these voting machines are antiquated. They're antiquated. Now, how old is this machine? All right, 45. If you were a mechanic 45 years ago, the younger generation, everything has changed. You take the new machines, you take the computers, and it's getting harder and harder. Like it's getting harder and harder to get parts. Or to complete a sentence was what I wrote at the end of that paragraph.
Now, is that cruel?
Is it cruel?
Yeah. To transcribe that and just mock her for...
I think what's cruel is that we have a public official who can't answer a simple question and who presides over a system that was the subject of a state investigation. An election was overturned. We have these things going on, and she and the others involved have done very little to reform it or to change the fact that it's just a patronage house. It's a way for them to hire employees. And she does not think or speak like I think a responsible public official should. And I think this paragraph is an example of her, you know, being evasive. She's not going to answer the question. And I think I don't think it's cruel. I think it's important to just call her on it, to say, look, where's the answer? You're rambling on. This doesn't make a lot of sense. What's the point?
You once took her to a shopping mall and did a column on that. What was that about?
Well, I was at the Democratic National Convention in Atlanta. I guess it was 1988. And I was following around the Pennsylvania delegates. And she, I don't remember if she was a delegate or an alternate, but she and a few other public officials, including two who prior to that time had gone to Las Vegas for a National League of Cities convention and were followed by a reporter who reported that they spent most of the time playing nickel slots in a casino and missing all of these workshops and symposiums. So here are the three of them in the bar when workshops and meetings are going on at the Democratic National Convention. And I looked at them and I said, what are you doing? And they said something like, well, you know, the meetings are kind of boring. And I thought to myself, well, what story can I get here? I said, shopping. They'd probably like to go shopping. And I had passed a shopping mall. And I said, what do you say? If I can get a car, you want to go to the shopping mall? And, you know, they jumped up off the bar stools. And I went and called the office, and I said, is it okay if I rent a limo to take, you know, the Boom Boom Sisters and Marge Tartaglione to a shopping mall? And they said, sure, go ahead. So I took them to the mall. And the point of it was that here
yes.
they should have been, you know, representing the city, attending the workshops, whether they were alternates or not. And they were, you know, lounging around the lobby and drinking and, you know, perfectly happy and willing to get in a limo and go shopping.
Gee, isn't that a little bit like, what's the word when a cop propositions a prostitute?
Entrapment.
Entrapment, thank you.
Well, shopping mall, that was definite entrapment on my part. I knew that the words shopping mall would get them. And I don't know. I mean, it's... I don't think that I handled it in a cruel way. I handled it in a light-hearted, sort of tongue-in-cheek way. And they knew what was going on. I mean, they participated.
So what did they think of your column?
Well, I don't remember whether they responded. I think one of them said, well, you gave us a few knocks, but it was kind of fun. It's a city, believe me, it's a city without shame.
One other column I have to ask you about. You went to a barber to get a mob hairdo.
Right.
How did you find the barber, and what was the inspiration for this column?
Well, when I first got to Philadelphia, that's another thing I was fascinated with, was the mafia and how it flourished and how, you know, everybody seemed to know, hey, you see that guy walking down the street? That's a mobster. And I forget whether the haircut was before or after I got thrown out of a mafia party celebrating a murder acquittal. I went to the Four Seasons and was literally thrown out of the party. But I got the reason for the haircut story was I was looking through the paper one day. And it was a day when about 15 mobsters were rounded up, indicted, arrested, whatever. And we had mugshots in the Philadelphia Inquirer. And I noticed that everybody in the mugshot had the same haircut. And so I called an attorney, a Philadelphia attorney, who represents a lot of them. And I said, Bobby, Steve Lopez of the Inquirer, working on a story here on the mafia. He said, what angle are you working on? And I said, the haircuts. I want to know where they get their haircuts. And he said to me, I had not talked to him before that. And he said to me, words I'll never forget, would you come out of a tree or what? And I, when I do interviews on the phone, I'm typing there on the other end, and I can't type that fast. Let me tell you. So I said, I wasn't even sure what he said. So I said, excuse me, could you repeat that? Would you come out of a tree or what? And I said, okay, out of a tree or what? Well, thank you. The thing is, Bobby, do you know where I can get a haircut like that? And he said, what are you, stupid? And I said, you know, I've just been all my life a step or two behind the fashion trends. And I thought if I get the haircut that everybody else in town has, you know, maybe it'll change my life. And he started to laugh at that. And he said, all right, here's where you go. And he told me what barbershop to go to. So I went down there and they said, what do you want? And I said, I want the mob do. And that was all I needed to say. He got out the scissors and started cutting.
Now, did the mob do look like a hairpiece, but it was the real thing?
Well, the thing is, short, brushed back. See, back, I had more hair at the time, and it worked a little bit. Right now, I'm not sure that a mob do would look very good on me. But it's...
You might need a little bit of the hairpiece up front, is that what you're saying?
That's right, that's right. And it's just a short brush cut, and it's all combed straight back. Yeah, it looks very sharp, very sharp.
Now, I believe you have a second novel in the works that's going to be about what you describe as hack Philadelphia politicians. There's obviously something about a certain kind of politician in Philadelphia that really interests you, and I'd like to see if you could describe what it is.
Well, I guess it's the last of the machine politicians that I'm intrigued by. At first, you find it the whole thing repulsive, that they play by this whole different set of rules, that it's okay to break the law if a constituent benefits. It's okay to put somebody on a ghost payroll if it's really a good kid. You know, it's okay to lie on an application and get somebody a college loan if in the end, well, he's going to benefit. Maybe he comes back and the neighborhood benefits. There is that school in Philadelphia. And as I said, when you first come here and you look at it, you think, my God, these are dinosaurs. You know, it's like Boss Tweed kind of stuff. When you get to know them, some of them, you find that there's some charm that goes with it. They maybe have some chromosomes bent or something. I mean, they don't quite think right, but they have a great deal of charm, and they really believe that that's the system that works. The system that works best is where instead of calling the streets department to fix your street, you call the guy on the corner who happens to be a committee man, who knows the ward leader, who can call this guy in Harrisburg, the state capital, and get this thing done like that. And along that route, everybody's getting some kind of a kickback. Everybody's got a piece of the action. And it sort of keeps them in business. And I'm fascinated by that. It's almost gone in American cities. And I want to write this novel is, in a way, I guess, a denouncement and a tribute. It's sort of a goodbye to those old-time machine politicians.
Steve Lopez, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Steve Lopez is a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. His new novel is called Third and Indiana. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the African-American middle class. Sociologist Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot has written a new book in which she follows the lives of six people who are at midlife. Lightfoot says she wrote her book in response to E. Franklin Frazier's sociological study, Black Bourgeoisie. She takes issue with its portrayal of the middle class as assimilationist, repressed, and disconnected from the larger African-American community. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review of a new CD that brings together three of his favorite musicians playing Schumann and Beethoven. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. says all diplomatic means to resolve the Haitian crisis have been exhausted. Madeleine Albright says the only choice for Haitian military leaders now is to leave. That's the same message President Clinton is giving in advance to his nationally broadcast speech tonight. He says there's no point anymore going on with present policy. There's no word if the president will set a deadline for Haitian leaders to get out. The White House has apparently offered to arrange safe passage out of Haiti for the military junta. Panama says it will not send military or police units to Haiti as part of a peacekeeping force. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama City.
Gabriel Luis Galindo, Panamanian foreign minister, clarified his country's participation in an inter-American peacekeeping force that will provide security once hostilities are over in Haiti. According to Mr. Galindo, Panama will not provide military or police forces, but will send instead a contingent of 100 doctors, nurses, and paramedics to help in the reconstruction of the island's health services once the legitimate government of Haiti is returned to power. According to Mr. Galindo, since Panama had suffered the effects of an American invasion, his government did not want to participate in any armed intervention. The Clinton administration had announced that Panama had agreed to join a list of 17 countries that would provide security to the government of President John Bertrand Aristide once he is returned to power. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Panama City.
The U.S. and North Korea have wrapped up several days of talks in Berlin. The North Koreans are still refusing to purchase new nuclear reactors from South Korea. The U.S. is pressing North Korea to replace its existing nuclear reactors with new ones, which do not produce plutonium, a component of nuclear weapons. The BBC's Charles Scanlon reports.
It's a dispute that's been brewing for some time, but now the battle lines are more firmly drawn. The United States has come out publicly in favor of a South Korean role. The Assistant Secretary of State, Robert Gallucci, is currently in Seoul, assuring South Korean leaders of American support. He says a solution is not feasible unless South Korea plays a central role in replacing North Korea's existing nuclear program. North Korea, however, is standing firm. It doesn't want help from South Korea and says it's up to the United States to come up with an alternative plan. North Korea wants to cut a deal with the Americans and exclude the South Koreans altogether. South Korea sees that as dangerous. It wants a role to ensure that the North complies with the agreed nuclear safeguards, and it wants to supply its own reactors as a first step towards economic integration on the Korean Peninsula.
Charles Scanlon reporting. The FBI says authorities have broken major drug trafficking operations between Italy and the United States. More than 100 people were arrested in both countries. On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 58 points today. This is NPR News. A Louisiana judge has ordered a homeowner to pay $653,000 to the parents of a Japanese student shot to death in 1992 when he went to the wrong house looking for a Halloween party. State District Judge Bill Brown rejected Rodney Pair's contention that he thought Yoshihiro Hattori was a crazed attacker. Brown says Pairs didn't use extraordinary care required by the law for using a gun, and he said the homeowner didn't need to kill the student to save himself or his family. Gunfire broke out today in the Liberian capital of Monrovia as soldiers from the former military government attempted to seize control of the city. African peacekeepers foiled the attempt. Cindy Shiner of Africa News Service reports.
Shooting broke out before dawn in Monrovia as soldiers of the armed forces of Liberia attempted to seize control of the executive mansion, where the cabinet of the transitional government meets. It was unclear if the soldiers had exchanged gunfire with African peacekeepers who guard the city. Tension has been rising in Monrovia since a peace accord was signed this week among three of the West African nation's six warring factions. Delegates to a national conference have condemned the agreement and called for the departure of the UN special envoy to Liberia, who brokered the accord. The security situation has deteriorated throughout this country settled by freed American slaves since disarmament aimed at ending the civil war broke down shortly after it began in March. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Shiner in Monrovia.
The Agriculture Department says it's seeing a lot more food stamp fraud. The agency says some recipients use their coupons for drugs, alcohol, other contraband, and restaurant meals. Ag Department workers say restaurants trade them for produce and meat. Investigators say fake grocery stores are springing up around the country to launder stamps at a cost of $2 billion a year. Regulators say they're trying to crack down on the fraud, but they point out the number of investigators has been cut nearly in half since 1979. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot is the author of the new book, I've Known Rivers, about the African-American middle class, the class she was born into. Her father was a sociologist, her mother a psychologist and pediatrician. Lawrence Lightfoot wrote this book to challenge the assumptions made by sociologist E. Franklin Frazier in his influential 1957 book, Black Bourgeoisie. Frazier said the black middle class turned its back on its roots and was living in a cultural vacuum. Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot's new book features extensive interviews with six middle-aged middle-class people. Lawrence Lightfoot is a professor of education at Harvard, a recipient of a MacArthur Award, and the author of a biography of her mother called Bomb in Gilead. The first time she heard about E. Franklin Frazier was 30 years ago, when her family and her parents' friends were sitting around the kitchen table.
My father started a conversation among his friends and colleagues. Many of them would have been considered at the time the black intelligentsia. And he said, "What do you all think about E. Franklin Frazier's new book, Black Bourgeoisie?" And my first response to that was one of total intrigue, just at the title, at the contrariness of those two words carried in that title. Because this was at a time when my maternal grandparents, who were also around the table and lived with us, were insisting upon calling us colored. And when my parents hated the term colored and were calling us Negroes, and when a whole sort of defiant, emerging left radical group was beginning to call us black, no one was calling us African American at all. And black sounded bold and aggressive, abrasive even, against this, the French lyricism carried in this word bourgeois. And so I was totally intrigued. But more intriguing was the conversation that followed, which was charged and heated and vigorous among these social scientists and social activists talking about this work. And I picked up, even as a young adolescent, that there was something both very true and very false about this work.
One of the ideas that E. Franklin Frazier expressed in his book, Black Bourgeoisie, was that the black middle class was assimilationist, that they became middle class by turning their back on their roots. Now, did you find any evidence of that among the middle class people who you interviewed?
Well, I would say that there were moments in their lives when they were in the ascent, as it were, when they were making the journey, when they each found it necessary to at some point relinquish some of the connections to their roots, or, as Katie Cannon would put it, make the great escape. But I think really, and this is particularly true, I mean, obviously, for those from backgrounds of poverty, but I think that one of the fascinating things about these stories, these life stories, is that they talk about the ways, the variety of ways, sometimes invisible to everyone else, of giving forward, of being activist in the community. Sometimes it's through great scientific discovery, differently conceived, differently expressed and represented, as it is in Tony Earls, who is an epidemiologist and psychiatrist who studies criminality and violence.
You thought that each of the people who you interviewed for your book became blacker as they matured. How was that expressed?
Well, I think that's related to what I was just talking about. I think that one of the ways in which we as black folks can feel more comfortable about negotiating the worlds that we negotiate, and many of them predominantly white, is to be more certain about our roots, to be more certain about who we are, and not feel ambivalently about that, not need even to shout about it or to be abrasive about it. And I think in each of these cases, if you look across these life stories, you see the development of a racial identity that is firmer and clearer and less ambivalent.
You went to a predominantly white school. Did you also grow up in a predominantly white neighborhood?
I grew up in a very odd community that was predominantly white. It was, in fact, an intentionally cooperative community. My father had been a conscientious objector during the war and had been a pacifist. Both my parents were pacifist, and many of them wanted to join together in a community that was intentionally inclusive and began this very strange, very wonderful cooperative community called Skyview Acres. And so I grew up in this place which was very sort of political and socially political, somewhat leftist, in the middle of the country.
Now, and how did your parents feel about you going to a predominantly white school?
They felt fine about that. There was enough, I think they felt, enough blackness and what I really refer to as a very African-American curriculum going on around our family table and in our lives, so that I think they really thought that their children were being exposed both to black culture and black roots and black literature and black history and black folks, as well as learning how to move in the white world successfully. And so I think they were teaching us very much the duality of that experience. They had, of course, grown up in segregated schools in the Deep South, in Mississippi. But come north, my father had gone to a predominantly black college, men's college called Morehouse College in Atlanta, where he had met all of these wonderful, wonderful intellectuals and social activists like Du Bois. But my mother had gone to Cornell University and been the only black undergraduate at the time, and had found that experience to be deeply isolating and lonely and painful. We had both examples within our family of a father who had in fact, until graduate school, which he did at Columbia University, this mostly black experience, and my mother who had this very black early experience, and then a wholly token experience. And I think they recognized that they wanted their children to be able to do both well, feel comfortable and thrive in both kinds of environments, and be able to move across those boundaries as gracefully as possible.
Was there a point in your life where your mother started telling you part of her story to prepare you what she feared you'd be up against as you started to pursue a professional life?
All the time. I mean, in other words, my parents, both of them, brought home stories of their work lives, unvarnished often, in which they would tell stories, often including stories of race, oppression, prejudice, bias, and we would listen to these stories and talk about them. So I remember early on these being very somewhat confusing, very complicated conversations about race and about oppression, about prejudice, and about one's response to those things.
My guest is Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot. Her new book about the black middle class is called I've Known Rivers. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot. When you were growing up, your mother worked, and this was at a time when most women didn't. How did you feel about her being gone?
It seemed very natural that my mother should work, although I began to notice that other mothers didn't work and were home and were there to take the brownies to their fly-up ceremonies and their meetings and so forth. I very much resented the time when my mother was supposed to be with us on a Saturday planting pansies in the garden, when she would have to respond to children who were sick in emergency and would leave us stranded in the garden, you know, the pansies half planted or the bread half made, and fly off in order to attend to these other children. That was very, very complicated and very difficult for me. And I was the kind of child who always spoke up about it, always expressed my rage and my anger. And my mother then had to face that upon her return.
Boy, I wonder how you feel about that now.
Well, yeah. I'm doing it, right? It's you know, you would need to talk to my children to, again, experience what they think of as these momentary abandonments and what they do with those.
So do you get these flashbacks?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My mother always wore a cape, and I often wear capes. And my feeling sometimes as I sweep out of the house in my cape is of watching my mother's cape disappear as well. So it feels like the echoes are very resounding in my own life.
As someone who's from a long line of middle-class African-Americans, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this issue. I know that some people who are African-American middle-class people have felt that if you're middle-class, your blackness might be challenged. You know, that so much of what is considered black now is defined by poverty, right?
I mean, not for me.
So did you feel like you were ever being challenged as being, you know, not black enough because you were from this line of middle-class families?
Well, certainly during the Black Power movement days, that is the late 60s, the early 70s, when I was a young adolescent, young adult, late adolescent, trying to really discover, as all people are doing developmentally, discover my identity, I certainly felt challenged by that notion. And there was a lot of, you know, blacker than thou talk, and a lot of worry within me that I wasn't being black enough. But that notion now doesn't disturb me at all. I feel not challenged by it. I am quite clear about my identity and know where I come from.
Is this an issue you investigated in your book?
It certainly is part of all of those stories to a certain extent. I mean, it isn't that race is the only shaper of these realities at all. There are lots of other shapers. We mentioned one earlier. That is, for the people from poverty, social class stands as a very, very powerful piece of their reality, and it still does. Tony Shizler, for example, who is now studying to become, has become by now, an ordained Episcopal priest, was a former nun and a research chemist, actually, but comes from a background of actually homelessness early on. Her mother was raped, and she was the product of a rape, and they lived a very fragile existence. And she was sent to a convent school for sort of protection from the streets, and emerged as a very, very disciplined scholar and a thoughtful young scientist, and emerged absolutely devoted to Catholicism and to the sanctity and piety of the Catholic Church. The first time she cries in our interview is not about race, but is about class. Her memories of the humiliation of being impoverished, her memories of going to this convent school that was mostly filled with middle-class bourgeois young girls, and where they had to wear uniforms, and where each of these young girls had seven white blouses, store-bought white blouses, to go under their blue uniforms. And Toni Shizler remembers that they didn't have any money to buy the blouses, and her mother made her three white blouses that she turned over each day, which probably no one noticed underneath those blue uniforms. But what she lives with still today is this feeling of humiliation at being not able to buy those blouses, and feeling just poor and diminished in the presence of those girls. And she lives today with closets full of blouses in all extraordinary colors, rich colors, white and many, many more, as a response to this early feeling of being diminished.
Do you think that people who are from middle-class families feel more secure in their middle-classness than people who changed class and became middle-class? Do they feel more vulnerable, that they can slip back into poverty at some point in their life?
I think some do, and I think that that continues to be a powerful legacy. I'm not sure whether it's about slipping back into poverty or whether it's really that these early primal feelings of impoverishment don't just rise up as difficult and painful echoes, even as they are secure in their middle-class status.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm glad to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot is the author of I've Known Rivers. She's a professor of education at Harvard. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton will address the nation tonight on Haiti. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, will you be looking ahead to that speech on All Things Considered?
Mara Liasson will be looking ahead, and we have a number of pieces related to Haiti and Haiti policy, including a conversation with someone from the nonviolent community who's taking a look at the possibility of an invasion for reasons of which he approves, an act of which he does not approve. The Tennessee Senate race is David Malbus's subject tonight. That's a race which gives you health care as an issue and a movie star as a candidate. Also, we'll look at the television schedule, and we will have listener letters tonight.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz's favorite musicians from the past have turned up on a single disc. They're not playing together, although they might have, as they were all British and living in England in the 1940s and 50s. Nevertheless, Lloyd says he's delighted with this reissue of some of their rarest recordings.
The three wind players on this collection may be the greatest artists who ever played their respective instruments. The best known in this country is Dennis Brain, the son and grandson of distinguished horn players. His recording of all four Mozart horn concertos under Herbert von Karajan in 1955 is one of the best-selling classical discs of all time. 2 years later, he was killed in a car accident. He was only 36. His intonation, his flexibility were not merely flawless, but profoundly expressive. His sound could be both intimate and heroic, and he was the perfect chamber partner. Here he is with pianist Dennis Matthews in Beethoven's F major horn sonata. The second player on this disc is Reginald Kell, who lived to be 75 but stopped performing at the age of 52 at the height of his career. He made a historic contribution to clarinet playing. By daring to add vibrato, he brought new color and warmth to an instrument that had stayed relentlessly monochromatic. He has the sweetest clarinet tone I've ever heard, with phrasing so nuanced you forget that his pitch is also perfect. He was an ideal Mozart player. Here, he's in a more romantic vein, in the first of Schumann's three Fantasiestücke. The pianist is Gerald Moore. Oldest of these three artists, oboist Leon Goossens, died in 1988 at the age of 90. Like Dennis Brain, he came from a musical family. His Belgian father and grandfather and his older brother, all named Eugene, were conductors. His two sisters were superb harpists. An interesting biography of the entire Goossens family by Carol Rosen is about to be published by Northeastern University Press. Like Kell, Leon Goossens was one of the hand-picked principals of Sir Thomas Beecham's London Philharmonic Orchestra. His sound was the voice by which you recognize that magnificent ensemble. It was that sound that also inspired Kell to add that expressive dimension to his own playing. No wind player has ever had a more spoken quality. But as he talks to you, he's also singing. This is from the second of Schumann's three romances, again with Gerald Moore. Each of these artists has a sound that is instantly identifiable and very human. They're all individuals with a very personal response to the music. We admire so many of today's players for their technique, but there's got to be more to music than anonymous perfection. That's one of the reasons it's so important to hear these marvelous old recordings.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Brain, Kell, Goossens, play Schumann and Beethoven on the Testament label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock, with Sue Spolin and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohn and Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, interviews with actors starring in new films. John Turturro is a contestant in Quiz Show. Samuel Jackson co-stars in the current film Fresh. And in perhaps the most anticipated full release, Pulp Fiction. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.